Synced. Okay, well, we're going to have in unsynced audio, and I'll figure out what's going on with, probably, I shouldn't use bleeding updates of operating systems. Anyway, all right, so, sunglasses. Let's talk about sunglasses. I don't have a whole lot to say about magnetic receipts, but the basic idea of sunglasses actually has to do with polarization. Expensive sunglasses, some cheap ones, but typically only expensive ones, are polarized. Does anybody think they can give the 30-second summary of polarization? Yeah?
It only allows 50% of light through a magnetic polarization angle.
Okay. This is true. Yeah?
Like, polarization, like, light comes in at a certain angle
that
the waves are, and so polarization is essentially like a grating that only lets through light that's facing towards a certain direction.
Yeah. So this is actually, it's really complicated to explain how this really works. Really complicated. What we have is that light is a particle and a wave. Okay? But the wave is interesting too, because it's both a latitudinal wave in an electricity, in the electric spectrum, which means therefore it's a longitudinal wave in the magnetic spectrum. I may have those two back, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. Because anytime you have a changing electric field, you have a perpendicular changing magnetic field. So it's mostly sort of pulsing forward, which is why two slit experiments work. Pulsing side to side, that doesn't work. Anyway, but you have this other one that's going the other direction. And since there's just two of them, that means that if any given photon hits the glasses, that magnetic, I'm pretty sure it's the magnetic, it might be the electric, signal is going to bump into the glasses at some arbitrary angle. Most sources of light emit all polarizations. They emit all angles. We call it polarization because of polar coordinates. They are rotating around the pole. All of the different angles around the pole of direction of travel, the magnetic wave could be going in any of those directions. There are certain materials that will probabilistically block a radiation depending on its angle. I might have this wrong, but if memory serves, the probability is proportional to the cosine of the angle and the desired angle to pass through. Anyway, it ends up blocking half of the light. So all of the light of one polarization will make it through. None of the light of the opposite polarization will make it through. Why would you do this on sunglasses? The answer is because reflections tend to polarize light. So if I hit some shiny surface at a sharp angle, and my wave was in one direction, I'm more likely to bounce off than if it was the other direction. Reflections off of mostly horizontal surfaces, such as, for example, the hood of the car in front of you, right? It's coming mostly flat. We're typically interested in this in the morning and at night, because that's when the sun tends to bounce off of cars and blind you. And so we tend to put these sunglasses that will block it. It also works off of water. So also water tends to be, when the sun is low, it bounces off the water, gets in your eyes, tends to be more polarized. So a polarized lens will cause more of the reflected light to be shaded than other kind of light, which is why we do polarization with these. However, because we have a polarized lens, and the fancy ones also like try to look cool and so on, all of those different visual effects, all of the like, let's put a mirrored substance over the top, and then let's put a thin film over top of that so that it looks sort of rainbowy to people at a distance, but not the person wearing the glasses, and so on. All of those interact in various ways, and so you tend, depending on the details of how it's constructed, you may see artifacts when you get strongly polarized light coming in. One other interesting thing about polarization, if the polarization of my lens is, say, horizontal, and I have something coming in at a diagonal, it will either get absorbed or make it through the other side horizontal. So it'll twist the magnetic field of the ones that make it through. So you'll have purely polarized light on the other side if you have a fully polarized lens. I don't feel like I did my best ever explanation of that. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Waves. Waves are actually literally the same phenomena we talked about last time. Okay? Almost exactly the same. Okay? So it turns out that like hot air rises and cold air goes down because of convection. And this tends to cause uneven heating, even if you have an even surface. And then often when we're driving, we are looking at a black road, okay, which is creating more heat than the green grass or whatever it is on the sides. And so we tend to have convection patterns over the road, and then the road turns, and there's cars that emit heat. There's lots of reasons the heat will vary. And again, air will tend to bend away from hot air and into cool air if it comes at a good enough angle for long enough. And so what that will tend to cause is as there's sort of, as there's hot spots and cold spots in the road, for whatever reason they happen to be there, that will tend to cause the air to wave around, and those are always moving because there's cars creating breeze, there's this ambient breeze, and the heat itself is creating wind, all of which are moving those things around. We may talk a lot more about that if we decide to spend the last part of the semester talking about fluid simulation. We may not. It's complicated to explain. And maybe we'll talk about Moyer patterns and eye spots another time. Because, I don't know, we should talk about something another time. All right. Let's dive into... I don't have my web browser open anymore. But that's all right. Magic will open it for me. Okay, so let's just briefly review what we did last time. So last time we talked about color, a lot of different things about color, different ways of representing it, how it comes out of out of physics, different color solids that artists like to use, a touch on gamma, just enough that hopefully you can be conversant with people that still talk about it. And we actually mentioned a little bit of HDR. HDR, or high dynamic range, referred to when we store more colors than we can display. And the reason we store more colors than we can display, we didn't really get into very much. So let's talk a little about how that works, and let's talk about exposure. To talk about exposure, let's start by talking about chemical film, old style cameras. The principles of chemical film will apply in other circumstances as well, but it's a nice clean way of talking about it. So, back in the olden days, like, you know, when I was your age, cameras had a piece of chemical film in there, multiple actual chemicals, and anyway, a little bit complicated, but the basic idea here is you put some chemical in here that needs illumination to give it enough energy to change form. And so as light hits it, any given little blob of chemical on it has a probability of saying, that was enough light, I am becoming exposed. And these are typically of microscopic size, very, very small little individual chemical compounds. And so as we shine light, right, if we shine a lot of light on the object in one area and less light in another, a lot more of these will become exposed compared to the ones in the dimmer areas. Okay? Because these are microscopic and there's a lot of them overall, this creates some area, the brighter areas get more exposure. And then we do some magic, depending on what the chemical is, to turn that into white where a lot of the chemical got exposed, black where it didn't, via very extra processes. But one of the things you want to think about as this is going on, okay, if any given photon comes and hits the black area versus the white area, an area that's mostly exposed, that photon has a lesser chance of causing any of the individual chemicals to hand work. He has a much higher chance of hitting one that's already been exposed. So the level at which the chemical degrades decreases the more of it gets degraded, because more of the light is hitting the stuff that can't react. And so in the dark area, it gets bright white faster than in the light area. Okay? And if we try to graph sort of the probability of an exposure compared to the previous exposure, I probably should have done this the other direction and not so close to the other image, but this will still work. Okay. So what I'd expect is that the probability of exposure is maximal when the previous exposure was nothing. So this is going to be my highest level. But every extra piece of exposure is going to reduce that likelihood. Okay? So the probability of exposure, depending on how much I previously got exposed, is going to asymptotically approach zero. it actually is going to reach zero because there's a finite number of chemical modules. But it'll get, if we have a high quality film and a large enough piece of it, it will take a really long time to get there. And this, just even without knowing anything about the chemicals involved, this always follows an exponential decay. This is always some kind of e to the negative something, right? Whatever we decide to call this variable. Okay? It's some sort of exponential decay behavior, which we could derive from calculus, but let's not bother. All right. Because of this, this is called the exposure curve, or the exposure function, or the exposure characteristic of film, how it ends up being exposed. We could simulate this directly in a computer. But we don't usually want to because it's a little bit messy to do all the multiplications. We don't know how steep to make the curve initially. It's a little bit awkward to try to do this. And so one of the benefits of HDR, high dynamic range images, is instead of storing in this sort of bounded either from none to all of the things turning white, we store the amount of light that would have happened. Okay? So a standard image, if we are using a normal image file like JPEG or PNG or something like that, we would expect this would be essentially the post-exposure. Okay? What would happen after exposure occurs? Whereas an HDR is traditionally at least approximating pre-exposure. Okay? And we would then need to apply an exposure curve to it in order to visualize the level of exposure that is present. So what does this look like? I linked here to a web archive copy of a page that I think does a reasonable job. Thank goodness for the web archive storing things on old sites that have gone kabust. All right. So this is a paper, this is an article by somebody that created a landscape rendering software. And so he has some examples from that software. Okay? And so here he has this model, he's doing outdoor scenes. He got an extremely bright sun that's sort of diffusing into the sky a little bit. We may or may not talk about how he does clouds and so on. And then you have a ground that's being illuminated underneath. And if you do some sort of just let's linearly cap off the total number of photons, you end up with either something that looks like a sky with a black ground or like you can't see the sun at all. And this is actually, your eyes are a chemical exposure system, okay? But your eyes are able to sort of readjust how much they're sensitive at different places. And so the idea here is that you store it all, but you apply this curve after the fact so that you can make it so that you can see the sun nice and cleanly and the ground fairly well as well. So you can see the clouds near the sun, you can see the ground. This is like a natural chemical photo appears. Now, we could compute it all in HDR and then expose it, then save it and give it to people. But we could also store it in HDR and give it that way, and then you could play with the exposure yourself. Okay? So this is sort of the first level concept of why we would want HDR. Questions about this? Yeah?
So the last image you saw, that was just like applying one curve to the whole thing?
That was, yeah, this is an exponential decay curve to the whole input file. Yep. Yeah?
How does a real camera capture HDR without, introducing its own exposure curve?
Yeah, so how do you capture HDR? There's a bunch of ways you can do it. Okay, first, it's almost impossible with chemical film. Computers-based film is actually similar. You have some sort of light sensors inside, and they also sort of get exposed, and there's some saturation characteristic in there. But there's a few different ways we can do it. One way we can do it is we can pick such a steep exposure that we're never going to get very far out here. If the brightest light in the scene is, say, that bright, this portion is more linear than this portion. So we get closer to doing it that way if we just essentially set the exposure really low. But for that to work, you need a really huge aperture to let in enough light to see anything, or a really long exposure time to let in enough light to see anything. Another way that some cameras will do this is they'll actually take multiple exposures of different durations. So you'll have a big aperture that will let in a whole lot of light, so you'd have to have a really fast exposure to not supersaturate. And you take a really fast exposure and a less fast exposure and less fast exposure and less fast exposure right back to back, where occasionally you can even sort of do it all at once. And then you combine all of those to approximate what the HDR should have been. Does this answer your question?
Yes.
All right. Yes?
You mentioned something about the eye being able to adjust versus
why. Yeah.
Why can't the camera be built that can do?
Well, cameras can. You can actually build a camera that does what the eye does, but what you can't do is build a camera that will create a picture that will act like your eye does as your eye scans over the picture. So let's talk a little about what happens with our eyes, right? We are in, let's say we've got some bright portion of the scene, and we've got some dark portion of the scene, whatever it is we're looking at, okay? Now, as you look at this scene, although you have peripheral vision, you look directly at something that you're interested in. It's almost impossible not to. You can force yourself to stare at one place and try to think about the thing you're not looking at. But it's awkward to do, okay? And that happens on a picture, that happens in the real world. You also have a dilatable pupil. And so what will happen is as your view is scanning across the scene, your pupil will dilate and contract and dilate, okay? And so your exposure will be sensitive to what you are looking at. It's not super, super fast at this, but it's reasonably fast at this. Also, your brain, your optic center, is to some degree undoing exposure after it sees it. You've lived all of your life with eyes that have an exponential decay fall-off function, and you have learned that as you look different places, different things look brighter and dimmer. And so your optic center is also countering it to some degree. Okay? So you have both the physical behavior of your pupil, you have your optic center, they're both undoing this as your gaze moves across the scene. And I can't readily make a picture that does that. But there are various cheats I could do. I could, I suppose, put eye tracking software on your computer, and as you look near the bright part of the scene, I change the exposure. You would probably find this disconcerting, okay? But I could also do some sort of, let's look at sort of the average brightness of pixels in this area to pick the exposure function I'm going to use here. Let's take the average brightness of pixels in this area to find the exposure function I'm going to use there. You do something like this so that the darker areas of the scene are actually rendered with a higher exposure. Okay? And there are various versions of this that are used at different times to try to create something where really dark areas are still visible and really bright areas are not. There is also, while I'm on this, a random tidbit. There's a professor in Canada who was talked about in the communications of the ACM a couple of years ago who for many, many years has been wearing a camera over one of his eyes. And then a little projector that sure shines into his eye, and he adds algorithms in between. So one of his eyes he just uses and the other one. Anyway, he's done this for like 20 some odd years. He used to wear a big backpack to power it before batteries became small. Anyway. And one of the things he has done is he has done this relative exposure. And he talks about how he doesn't understand how anybody else drives at night. Because then they see headlights, they don't also see the face of the driver. And how does that work? Right? So you could argue that maybe we should do this all of the time, in real time, with everything we do. But our eyes aren't quite that good. And so we have to do it this way instead. All right. So, this is the idea of a post-applying exposure. There are other things we can post-apply. Let's just do, because it's shut down, I don't have all of my pre-prepared images, but let's just say, let's look for, hopefully this will work. Nope. Yes, this will work. All right. This is actually a computer-rendered scene, but that's okay. We can still use it to talk about something that happens in the real world. Okay. If we look at this scene, you will notice that this appears to be glowing. Admittedly, this is computer generated, so it's glowing because they decided to make more pixels there. But why does it appear to be glowing? Why should it appear to be glowing?
Because
Yeah.
Optics aren't perfect, so you're going to kind of get a little wiggle room on very bright sources, more noticeable.
Yeah. So the concept is the sun is reflecting off of something shiny, and there's way more light there. But your optics aren't perfect, so the physical lens on your eye and any glass you're looking through and everything are all going to diffuse a little bit of light. And so we get this little halo here. What's really happening is the whole image is just barely being blurred. In the real world, that's what's happening. The real world doesn't say, oh, that's a bright light, let's make it glow. Okay? It just makes everything glow so little that you can't notice it. Because the amount of bleed of the light is very minor. But when this is extremely bright, we can see that bleed. Okay? We can see that extra little effort, right? And sometimes computers do this fairly poorly and it looks kind of like a fuzzy, glowy ball. And other times they do it pretty well and it looks sort of like this. Also, you'll notice there's like these streaks coming off of it, which are designed to represent how glass is polished. Okay? This is not some, and so if you wear glasses or you're looking through a camera or the like, there will usually be some kind of directional, it blurs more in this direction than in other directions, which creates what we sometimes call various kinds of lens flare. Lens flare is actually a fairly complicated set of topics. That's also where we get these little circles here. Those are supposed to be representations of dust on the lens. Okay? And some light hits that dust and bounces around, and all of the light would hit the dust and create this sort of after image, but we only see it where it was extremely bright over there. This almost certainly was not generated by representing everything having these little bursts of fuzz at really low exposure. But if all it did was give us just the HDR image, we could tweak the amount of lens bloom and lens flare in the image viewer at very low cost. Okay? So sometimes creating, storing, and sharing these HDR images allows us to do cooler things in how they're presented and to adjust them after the fact without having to re-render everything. And so this is some of the reasons we care about HDR. Any questions about HDR or exposure? Okay. The other topic we had for today before we jump into doing a little advance of what we had for Tuesday was image compression. What image file formats do you commonly use? The originator of the format would be proud of you. The rest of us cringe. Anything else?
TIFF.
Sorry?
TIFF.
TIFF? Wow. Old school.
WebP.
Ah, new school. Sorry, I heard two at the same time. I actually don't know that one. Yeah.
CR2.
CR2? All right. Yeah.
Does SVG count?
I believe it does. Yeah.
HEVC.
Sorry?
HEVC.
HEVC. Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Lots of image formats. Why are there so many? It's just a raster of pixels, right? Well, actually it isn't. I think we only have one here that is, this is a vector graphic format. I think all of the rest of these, I'm not super familiar with the innards of a couple of them, but I think all of the rest of these are raster instead, okay? So an SVG file is an XML file that describes where to draw lines. And that's all it is. It isn't really, in the raster sense, a picture yet. It's what your homework one would. Homework one doesn't actually use SVG input because I didn't want to make you write an XML parser. But it's pretty close. And if you do the right set of optional things and then change your input format, you could turn an SVG into one of these other things with your homework one. Okay? But then we have all of these others. Some of these three. are uncompressed. Although actually all of these now have the option of, well, I don't think PPM still does. But these are traditionally uncompressed. What do I mean by uncompressed? I mean, we list the exact color of every pixel in raw form. You open them up in a hex editor and you will see, ah, this byte is 255. That means some color is all the way on in some pixel. I will change that to 0 and that color will go to not go off on that pixel, right? You could directly interact with them. And they differ primarily in little nuances of how they work. BMP was a pragmatic file format created by as a part of the window, I believe Windows 3.1. They were first starting to create visual interfaces to computers, and they needed a way of showing like icons exist. That means we need colors, right? So BMP came out of that. TIFF came out of trying to make higher quality images that we could use in graphics. So TIFF supports more colors than BMP. And then PPM was invented to say, I don't want to have to think about what's going on. It should sort of look like text. And so there's actually different versions of PPM, but some of the most common are literally just ASCII representations of the colors of pixels. Although there's a little bit of variation here. But these just store all of the information. And these suffer from the problem we talked about last time about storage space. Pictures are big. They're bigger than we need. The rest of these, again, I'm not uber familiar. Let me just comment. I have not looked up the inner encodings of these three. So I could be wrong about what I say about those three. I have vague ideas about some of them. Others I don't. Anyway, the rest of these I know quite well, though. So the rest of these try to compress information. There's several different approaches to compression. Let's start with the simplest. GIFs or GIFs, they compress in a simple way. First, they say, only use a few colors. GIF or GIF, depending on whether you like what the originator said or what the consensus of the community has said, and I really don't know why everybody disagrees about how to pronounce it. Anyway, I mean, the person that originated it, when first published, said it should be pronounced GIF. And everybody else said it stands for graphics image format. It can't be GIF, it's because it's not graphics. Anyway, and they just told him no. And that's a weird thing to do to somebody that invents a file format. Anyway. Okay. So, this is limited to no more than 256 colors. So you know you can compress each individual color in no more than one byte. You can actually use fewer colors than that because it starts with a list of what all of the colors are. So it says, in this image, color 0 is black, and color 1 is orange, and color 2 is green. Those are the only colors I want. Now I only have to encode 3 bits. Or 2 bits, right, to encode 3 colors. Okay, so that's one way they get around this. Then they also use various other techniques, but basically they use sort of a lossless compression. I don't know, because I don't think we teach it in the core, but it may be something you've learned along the way. How many of you could at least vaguely hand wave over how to do a lossless compression? No, probably not. All right, we're split almost half and half. One lossless compression you've already seen in 2150, what do you use binary trees for? Huffman encoding. This is a lossless compression. It turns out to be it's at once provably optimal and pretty bad in practice. Anyway, it's not what we actually use here. There's other techniques we can use here. This, I believe, traditionally uses, it's one of the LZs. I think it's LZW compression, which is based off of when we see a sequence of bytes, that we sort of store it essentially in a map or dictionary. And then when we see that again, we put the index into the things we've seen in the past. And there's some rules about forgetting things. Anyway, it's sort of a memoization type of approach to how we do this, if you're familiar with that concept from algorithms. So algorithms are not a prerequisite for that, so it's not hugely important. But the basic idea is we just say information tends to repeat. we're going to notice when it repeats and store the repetition shorter. It's basically what we're doing here. Okay? PNG is also lossless, and also a lossless compression. Okay? It allows as many colors as you want. It can actually store as many colors as TIFF, which very few of these can do. So it can have 16 bits per color if you wanted to make a total of 48 bits per pixel. And it can actually have a 16-bit alpha as well. Anyway, so it's lossless. Its approach is based on a slightly more sophisticated model. It's going to say any given pixel is likely to be similar to one of the three pixels, these three pixels. Okay, it's likely to be similar to the pixel right before it, the pixel right above it, or the pixel diagonally left before it. We find the one that was most similar to it, and we replace it with the difference between those to make it into a smaller number. Then there's this sort of extra step that's weird to describe, where we do an extra little transformation on the rows, subtracting things in another way. We store which version of those we did for that whole row, and then we throw that whole thing into a sort of a gzip-based compression. Where gzip-based compression is also a lossless compression. It's a little bit more complicated than LZW, but it basically involves taking chunks of data and sorting them, and then storing how you sorted them, sort of. And then because they're sorted, there's more repetition that we can get rid of other ways. Anyway, compression is a complicated topic and truly beyond the scope of what we're doing here. But this uses some sort of image-specific information and tends to make fairly good compression if your image has large regions of relatively constant color. It tends to do very well for things that we create with computers, which tend to have very nice, smooth gradations. It tends to do very poorly for things to do with cameras, which tend to have a lot of individual noise between pixels because the real world is noisy. And so we have that. And then we have the others. They're going to be harder to explain. So before I dive into any of those, questions about any of these? Yes?
For some of the lossless ones you mentioned, like PNG, is it possible to lossily compress them as well?
No. I mean, I guess you could try to do something that isn't PNG on top of it, but PNG does not have a lossy mode. Okay. Yes?
So if you can compress it losslessly, then why would you want to use something like the uncompressed formats?
Right, because it's easier to read and write and handle. And because backwards compatibility never goes away. Okay? So you will sometimes need to go open up an old image. So like PPM is primarily used by people that need to write images but really don't want to think about file formats at all. It's designed to be trivial to parse. BMP is used by people that have old code and don't care about space. TIFF used to be the easiest way to store giant image programs. It's actually partially designed to be able to have images larger than you can fit in memory, because this used to matter a lot. And so it's partially designed to be easy to access the portion of the image you want to work on, has some odd tricks to it to make that work. Yeah?
Also, can you have animated PNGs?
So there's no obvious reason why any of these would or wouldn't have animation. GIF store or GIF stores animation just by having a whole bunch of pictures and information about when to switch. It's not an animation format in the usual sense. Okay? It does a little bit of sharing of the compression between frames, but it's basically just show this image, show this image, show this image. Movie formats tend to encode the difference between one frame and the next, which these don't. In theory, any of these could do that, but they don't. And GIF does, and therefore it is still alive, even though if it wasn't the only one web browsers would animate without a plugin, it would probably have died a long time ago. Okay, because it just tends to compress even the same image worse than PNG on average. So PNG would sort of have replaced it if PNG had decided to include in the file format animation, is my guess. Yeah?
Do all of these have like an alpha channel?
No. In fact, of the ones I have noted so far, TIFF and PNG do. GIF actually doesn't, even though it has transparent. Instead, there's one, you can pick one color to be the transparent color. So it has no half transparent. It's either all the way or not at all. And so it allows you to sort of superimpose pixelated images on top of backgrounds. Yeah?
Do any of them support progressive lighting?
Yes. PNG does. JPEG does too. Progressive loading is the idea that, progressive loading is probably worth talking about by itself. I have a big image. It's going over some tiny little pipe. Okay? So it's coming through very slowly. When I have 10% of the image file delivered, what can I draw?
10%.
Well, right, so there's basically three answers. Nothing at all, which is surprisingly common. Many file formats are designed, you write some header, you write all of the data, and at the end, you write how much data you had and what it all meant. So you can write the whole file in one go, but that means you have to read to the end to read the file. Okay, most image files aren't like that. So most of them will just start filling in one pixel at a time in rows. And you'll start seeing that like appear to come out of a slow printer or something, right? A progressive will do something else. The most common version of progressive is we will say for every 8x8 block or something like that, I'm going to give you just one pixel. So I'm going to give you this grid of pixels, and before you have gotten through all of those, just blur it out so that it looks like a fuzzy version of the whole image. And then I'll come back again and I'll give you these pixels so that we can sort of maximize how much more information I have. And then I'll come back after that and I'll give you these pixels and so on. There's different versions of how this works, but we just sort of encode the pixels not in order so that when you have a subset, it spreads over the image instead of not. There's no reason why most of these couldn't do that, but of these, I believe PNG is the only one that does. And most of the time, PNG doesn't. It turns out that we have a lot higher speed connections than we used to. And so it is relatively uncommon to care as much now as we used to do. Although it still happens. Other questions about these before we jump into the weirdness of JPEG? All right, let's jump into the weirdness of JPEG. And I'm going to try to do this without assuming you've had advanced math classes, which is going to make my life a little bit complicated. All right. Let's do it this way. Let's come back to... This is not a great image for it. Let's just arbitrarily pull out, I don't know. Let's look. This is a reasonable one. Let's pull out this image. I have no idea what this is supposed to be. Glowing pots?
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, great. So we have some glowing flower pots next to water. Doesn't really matter, okay? As we look at this image, one of the things you will notice is that most regions of the image have a slow gradation of color, okay? If I take any given fairly small block of it, I will see it mostly just sort of goes from one color to another smoothly. Or maybe it has like a sort of a peak and a drop or so on, but most small regions are going to be fairly smooth. This observation motivates the core concept of JPEG, which is called the discrete cosine transform. We are definitely not going to try to work through the math of this. It's not that bad to do, but I don't want to spend the time on the math. What the discrete cosine transform does is says, okay, if you give me some, we'll simplify it even more than we have to. If you give me a square of pixels, you give me any square of pixels, I can represent any square of pixels by the sum of various other principal squares. Okay, so I am going to, you have some shape, I don't know, and it's got something in it. Okay, and I'm going to say that is the result of adding a bunch of other squares all on top of each other. Okay, so I'm just going to add up pixel intensities. And these images I'm going to pick are a solid color. Okay, and then I'm going to have what I'm going to oversimplify a little bit, a linear gradient. So it's going to start at one color and go sort of smoothly to another. And I'm not great at doing this with this graphics tool, but right. So the idea is that one side's one color, the other side's the other color, it goes smoothly across. And then we can have a linear gradient in this direction. Okay, and a few other linear gradients, and we can add these up and we can get a bunch of things. And then we can have like a bilinear gradient. So we can have the sort of it starts one color and gets darker, and then you get, right? So I can have it switch colors, and I can make sort of waves, cosine-like waves of intensity. Okay? So way down in the list of these, there will be somewhere down here one that I'm not going, so it's going to essentially have a dark part and a light part and a dark part and a light part and a dark part and a light part, right? And we take the right mix of these at the right intensities with the right base colors, we add them all up together, and mutatis mutandis, we can create any image. How to figure out what these are and how bright they are and what color they are is what the discrete cosine transform does for us. So we can do this, and we could do this losslessly. It can create any set of pixels. What we actually do in JPEG then, is we take our big picture and we chop it into chunks, square chunks. Usually 8x8 or 16x16, sometimes bigger, but we chop it into square chunks. For each of these chunks, we compute that sum of images that we would want. Now, because the order of these is always the same, we basically just have to store a tiny bit of information for each of them. And then we just delete the ones at the end. Okay? The ones at the end are giving us our very small level details. So we can either just say we get rid of all small level details, or we can say we delete them once the magnitude of their effect is small enough. We truncate that, we can store that with less information than we could all of the pixels, and we store that information for that block. And then we do it again, usually completely separately for the next block. JPEG does completely separately. Okay? So we just take each block in the image, we figure out what this whole sequence would be, we decide some point to chop it off, we throw away the rest, and we store just the information to create the first part, which is a smaller number of blocks for each of the blocks. And because usually when we look at images, we see large regions of gently shaped color, we do pretty good. And because our eyes tend to sort of, our visual center tends to extract out lines and patterns and big features, those are preserved very well by this. But small scale features aren't, okay? And so we actually saw that a little bit a couple of times ago when we talked about the telephone lines. Let's see if we can get a similar picture again. All right, so if we pick one of these and we try to zoom in on it, let's see if I can successfully do that. And we turn out the lights. Okay. You will notice there's like little, it's not beautiful to see on this. Maybe here is a clear spot. We have some like artifacts away from the line. What's happening there is there's a rectangle, probably about there, that includes this wire. It needs a very narrow dark with light around it. Very narrow means we have to go very far down the list of cosine transforms. We don't want to go very far down, so we're going to cut it off early, which is going to sort of create waves farther out in the image around the wire as a side effect of the fact we chopped it off. Those will only go out so far because we did this for a square. And so we go over far enough, we'll suddenly cross that magical boundary and we'll just have nice smooth background. Okay? But this is commonly how a lot of times, this is what we call a lossy compression. The image we store is not the original image. Okay? It's a different image. We have lost some information. Okay? So JPEG and related things, it's lossy because I'm storing a different image than I started with. But it has very high visual efficiency. So with a small image, I can make something that looks more like real scenes than most other file formats. Not great for like cel animated hand-drawn things, but great for photographs because they tend to have this characteristic. Yes?
Can you
Is there like a rule of thumb for like how many terms of the transform stores, or does it use some kind of approximation metric?
So the typical rule is we actually give a threshold of accuracy. So we say we want the final image to be no more than X percent different than the original image. I might actually be able to show that. Let's pull up the GIMP. All right. I had not planned to do this, but we've got a little time. Why don't we? Let's make ourselves a nice small image here. Hey. And I'm going to zoom way in on it, except I didn't really want it to go with, all right. This is, I'm used to using this HDR mode. All right, so I'm going to zoom in on this, and I am going to, I don't know, let's use a paintbrush tool. Okay, I've created some image. It's a really ugly image, but great, this will allow me to do things. I'm now going to export this as, I'm going to, I don't know, let's just throw it down in my temp directory, which is completely empty because I just restarted. And I'm going to save it as a JPEG. And hopefully I can make all of these bits and pieces work. Okay, so let me see if I can get this out of the way. And I'm going to show a preview. All right, so I have a quality percentage. I'm just going to start dropping this quality. At zero quality, okay, this is essentially, and you might be able to see, here is clearly a box. It contains just the edge of this, and decaying just the edge of this, I sort of have this dark light wave. Okay? And as I get any better, it gets a little better. Okay, so there at 3%, it allowed me to add one more set of transforms. And I can keep getting better. I can make those features smaller and smaller. And what is this percent? It's for each box, I go until I am no more than this percent different in the total pixel average. I could use other ways, and I could also say, oh, let's find our, let's use the fast integer version with, I don't know, we can change lots of features about how the deceit cosine transform works, okay, to try to do extra kinds of fudging. But the basic model is I just keep adding transform, keep adding factors until I say, ah, that looks about good. Right, that was way too well, right? So like I say, yeah, that's good enough. I've got a few little glitches over here, but I don't think people will notice them. And then I say I'm good to go. A year ago or 2 years ago, I guess when I last taught this, I just randomly just tried pulling random JPEGs I got off of just searching images with file type JPEG. Most of them were compressed somewhere between 75 and 90%. But I don't know that that means anything besides that's the ones that came at first in image search. Other questions? Yes?
If you do like 75 to 90%, does that have like the same effect to the file size? Like is it like direct?
Yeah, so look at this file size. 75%, I'm 1.2 kilobytes. Let's go up to 90. I'm 1.5 kilobytes. Most of my image, it doesn't matter. Most of my image is big solid colors. Okay? If I were using a photograph, it would change much more rapidly. Right? If I were to say I want lossless, I'm only at 2.2 kilobytes in this because most of those boxes are one solid color, and so I only need the first one. Okay? It's just the boxes where there's some change that I need to do anything, and many of those fit in fairly nicely. So this is an image that is easy to compress in any way. I compress it losslessly in JPEG if I really wanted to, although you almost never see a lossless JPEG. Typically because if I can compress it losslessly in JPEG, I can compress it more so losslessly in PNG. Not always, but usually that's the case. But how this differs depends on how much detail there is in the scene. And so with big regions of flat color or big regions of smooth color, doesn't make a lot of difference. You can do high quality with low cost. But if you're like taking a picture of somebody with curly hair, for example, lots of individual little detail that's all sort of important, and so you'll see a much steeper curve in file size. Other questions? Okay. Let me close this out and come back to what we were doing. So, we've left off a few. Most of the rest of these are, I'm not 100% sure about all of them, but those that I know about, I think those that I don't as well, just from what I know about them. They're also lossy, like JPEG, okay? So this was lossy. And they actually use similar techniques, but usually just more advanced math. So it turns out discrete cosine transform is pretty cool, but wavelets are even better, and so on. You just different ways of creating sort of baseline additable things. Some of them will even analyze a region of this picture, try to compress it with a PNG-like thing, try to compress it with a JPEG-like thing, see which one is better, and do it region by region in different ways. Of course, then you have to store what you decided to do, which adds space, right? So that's not an unambiguous benefit. Some of these will also be able to store HDR, and so on. There's different extra things you can add, but these are the basic techniques we use for most image compression. Any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns, rebuttals about image compression? All right. So we have finished with, I think I drew a picture about this, but maybe not. Oh, right, that was an earlier version. Okay, anyway, so we have image compression. I have 12 minutes. Let's talk about DDA. This one you actually have to do for your homework, so hooray! Useful. DDA stands for the Digital Differential Algorithm. That is so not important. Most people I know that do graphics don't know that. Okay. It is an approach for figuring out how to draw a pixel. In particular, how to draw a line. And it is designed to draw a line from any arbitrary point to any arbitrary point on a grid. It most commonly draws 8 connect lines, as say at most 1 pixel per row, or per column, depending on which way it's going. But as we talked about earlier, you can change between those and 4 connect lines fairly easily by adding a few extra pixels in predictable places. The concept of DDA is based on vectors. So I'm going to talk about vectors. If you don't know vectors, we'll have a day, we'll talk some more about them a little later. But I would also suggest looking them up because they were something that I think I said was a prereq for this course. So here I have the line. This is the real line. Okay. The goal of this algorithm is to find, let's assume in this case I am stepping in y, so I'm going to find the y, where this line crosses each integral y. Okay. Let's assume that one's just beyond, so I won't get there. Maybe that's supposed to be right on it. I don't know. We'll pretend that happened to be an integral y there. So find where the line crosses integral y is at what x each of those are, and then round those over to the pixel center that ought to draw them. Okay? And then fill those pixels. Or do something else with them. We'll actually use DDA for multiple purposes. The rounding is pretty easy. It's rounding. There is some nuance about what to do if you're exactly halfway in between that actually matters for some graphics. But deciding what it is usually enough. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about triangles, which we almost certainly won't get to today. But we just basically, we find the nearest pixel for the basic line drawing approach. Now, the trick is to find these points efficiently and accurately. To do that, since I happen to have an integer here, let's start with the easy half, and then we'll talk about the real half. The easy half is, I say, okay, let's find this offset. Okay? I find this vector. If this was point A and that was point B, then this vector here, let's arbitrarily call it x, therefore, would equal the end of it minus the beginning of it in vector math. So I find that vector. I don't want this whole vector. I want a vector that will get me from one of these spots to the next one. So I take this vector and I divide it by its length in y, in this case. Okay? So I take x and I want to find not just x, I want to find this vector that would take me from one of those points to another. Let's call that y. So y is going to equal x divided by x's y. Okay, so I say this was, what was this? This was 1, 2, 3, 4 and a half-ish, 4 1/3 y components. So I divide by 4 1/3, I get one that's the distance between two consecutive points. And then I just find the first point. In this case, I'm going to say A was the first point. So what are all of the points? I had A plus y. I had A plus 2y. I had A plus 3y. And I had A plus 4y. And so that I just keep adding the vector to get from one point to the next. I have one division to do, but otherwise I'm just adding. Adding is easy. Okay? Adding is fast. Adding doesn't have much sort of numerical error and so on, so I can get where I need to go quite quickly. We're going to add a nuance that makes this vaguely more complicated, but before I do that, any questions about any piece of this? Yes?
What is the x sub y?
X sub y is the y component of the x vector. Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't have called these x and y, should I have? Yeah. Yeah, okay. I don't know if I want to do it again with different letters. All right, we're going to change our x's to p. I don't have them a whole lot of places, that'll work. Okay. That's p and p. And then my y here, we're going to call instead q. And so this is q here as well, and q, and q, and q. Let's make this that color to suggest that it's just a coordinate. Yes?
So py there, is that the magnitude of it in the y direction?
Yep. It's the y coordinate of the p vector. Yeah?
So how is like the distance between all of like the points for the q vector the same? Because like some are on the right side of the line, some are on the left side.
So this finds these points. And then I round each one individually. So I find the real points, and then I round them, finding them to be in pixels. Other questions? Yeah?
Are you guaranteed to have one per column? Well, in this case, there isn't one.
This is guaranteed to have one per row.
Okay.
If I'm stepping in y, because I used a y here, this guarantees one per row. If I'd use x, I'd be guaranteed one per column instead.
But in this example, isn't there like a gap?
Yep. So this is probably should have picked x instead, so that I wouldn't have a gap. But I misread the line I sketched, and so I picked the wrong direction. Well, actually, turn out that very often when we use DDA, we'll step in y even if it has gaps. But we'll see more about that when we talk about triangles. Other questions? Okay. Now, I happened here to start at an endpoint. That usually won't work. If I had started at B, for example, in this graph, I wouldn't have ended up with things that were lying on the centers of y's. I'd ended up with things below those. And that would be the wrong x for drawing my lines. So the more common case, there's an extra step we do first. Let's step in x this time so we can make that a little bit clearer. Let me not make things as central. All right, so I have here some line I want to have from A to B. Okay. And I'm going to step in x this time, so I want to find these points here so that I can then round them to draw them as lines or use them for other things to draw a triangle. Most of these are going to be, again, I'm going to take P is B minus A. And then I'm going to say that Q, to use the same layers we had, was P divided by P's x coordinate. And that is going to give me here my Q is going to be the distance between two of these points. But that is longer than the first distance here. okay? Because it has distance 1 in x, and a is not 1 away from this. So in addition to having this q, I also need to sort of jumpstart it with a special value here. Let's call that, pq, I guess r. Why not? Okay? I'm going to use r exactly once to get to the point I want to be. And then I'll use q thereafter. Okay? So how do I figure what r is? Well, r is going to be this distance. Let's call that d. So r equals d times q. Okay? Because I know that q, by construction, has length 1 in x. I know the length I want in x is d. So I just multiply by d, and I find that initial offset to get me to the first point. And so now I can find exactly where this line intersects every integral x. I start with an endpoint, I add r once, and then that gives me the first one, then I add q, 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 all the way up. To figure out what d is, I just am going to figure out what is the next integer above a. Above a is x, and subtract that off. So how far away is a from an x? Or below if I was going to the left. And so with this, I can generate all of these points precisely, or at least within what I can get with rounding error. And this is the concept of DDA, yes?
Why do you need r?
Why do I need r? If I don't have r, if I start by adding q, so if I say a plus q, since q has length 1, that will find me that point. Not this one. It is a point on the line, but it isn't a point in the middle of a pixel. And you may say, I don't really care, it'll still work. And you're sometimes right. Okay? If you're just saying, I want to draw a line, and you're off by half a pixel, who's going to care? But if you say, I want to draw a whole bunch of lines next to each other to make something that looks nice, solid, and connected, and some of them are a little off from each other, then we end up with little gaps, and you start seeing it. So we actually do care about precision of way less than a pixel's magnitude in most graphics applications. Yes?
Why did we use R for the vertical example?
I just happened to draw A already being there. So there would have been an R, but R's magnitude was going to be 0. Yes?
Does it matter which end of the line you choose? Is there like any heuristic factor?
No, it doesn't really matter. Typically, you write your code to always start at the same direction. And that might matter depending on what you're doing with the results. So it turns out that most frame buffers are slightly faster to read left to right than right to left. But the differences are small enough, you usually don't care. Other questions? All right, this is DDA. DDA is widely used. It's a workhorse of a lot of what we're going to do. It's built into graphics cards. It has several thousand or million of them that all run at once in hardware. Anyway, it's big and important. There is, however, a way of making it faster, which we'll at least start explaining. I'm not sure how far we'll get. The Bresenham algorithm. Now, Bresenham designed Bresenham's algorithm separately from DDA. At least that's what I think happened. I found the history of this to be surprisingly opaque. I'm pretty sure they were divided separately, just happened to be similar. But to understand Bresenham, first thing to understand about Bresenham is that it assumes integer endpoints. Okay, so if I know that I have a line that starts and ends exactly in the center of a pixel, first off, that means I don't need r, because it's always going to be 0. That makes my life easier. Okay? But also, if it's exactly integers, then I should be able to figure out exactly what the coordinates are here. So this particular case, my p, my separation, if we call this a and b, my p would be, let's actually commit the actual number. It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in x. and 2 in Y for this thing I have drawn. Okay? Now I could, right, the normal thing to do here would then be to say that my Q, if I'm going to step in X, is going to be 1 and then 2/5. But 2/5 in binary is an infinite repeating fraction I cannot store exactly. I am going to have round off, and floating point numbers are more complicated in UGG. Okay? And so Bresenham realized I can handle fractions without handling fractions. Okay? So Bresenham said, if I want to know the pixels that I am in, instead of finding these exact points, I just need to know at every step, do I stay in the same pixel or do I go up to the next one? That's all I need to know. So I'm just walking in X and maybe going up one in Y, maybe not. As long as I pick this shallower slope to walk in, it's always either 0 or 1 away. So how do I know if it should change? Well, let's think about the Y coordinates of these points. Let's just arbitrarily say this was 8, okay? So that's going to be 8 2/5. That's going to be 8 4/5. And that's going to be 8 6/5, which is the same thing as 9 1/5. Okay? And so on as I go along. So now I have 9 3/5. And then I have 10, or 9 5/5. Okay? Bresenham's observation was, I don't need to store the fraction. What I am doing is adding over and over again, I am adding that number. So I take the original difference, I keep adding the rise, and anytime the sum gets bigger than the run, I subtract the run from it and I bump up a pixel. Okay? He actually starts at half of the run as the initial value so that it centers instead of doing other things. With just integers, just seeing if they have gotten just integers, integer comparison, and adding 1, you can find all of the pixels of a line exactly. No rounding error, no floating point numbers, no divisions. It is an extremely fast way, assuming your pixels start exactly in the center of the pixel. Question.
Is your drawing kind of shifted over by a column or something? Because it looks like it goes up a pixel on the 84.
Yeah, I didn't draw a straight line, did I? And notably, I said this is 8, and this is 9, and this is 10. So I'm doing the centers of the pixels are the integers. So this one is just above 9. Okay? So you can draw pixels where the corners are the integers instead, but typically we think about the centers of pixels being integers because it makes it easier to draw them. All right, that's the time we have. We'll come back on Tuesday. We'll talk more about how we do this to make triangles and so on, but you should already be able to do part of homework 1. I would encourage you to start.